I teach a class about the history of stand-up comedy. What is a stand-up comedy? What are we even talking about? Well, stand-up comedy is one person standing on stage in front of an audience with the expectation of evoking laughter from that crowd. That is the mission statement of the job. You have to stand there all by your lonesome, trying to make them laugh. It's terrifying when it doesn't go well. We actually refer to it as bombing. And it's thrilling when you connect with the crowd and you go on this comedic journey together. And together is the key word. It's an interactive art form. So it's a very intense experience. I know because I've been doing comedy for over 35 years. Now, since stand-up has become commercialized, which is, oh, I can make a living doing this, there's always been a premier booking back in the vaudeville days. The premier booking was a place in New York City called the Palace Theater. If you did well at the Palace Theater, you could tour the country. It was a stamp of approval. After the Palace, there was the nightclub generation, the number one place to play during this era that really would solidify you as a comedian that could go to Vegas and open for Mitzi Gaynor if you did well at the Copacabana in New York City. The Copa was the new palace. And then television hits, the Ed Sullivan Show. Then Johnny Carson became the king of late night. So suddenly David Letterman from Indiana goes to LA to get on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Gary Shandling, Robin Williams, Jim Carrey, Jay Leno, all converge on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Other new venues pop up that become great premiere bookings, getting an HBO special. Suddenly you could do a whole hour special on cable television. Then hosting SNL was a big thing. For a while, there's cable television, there's Evening at the Improv, and then the internet. Starting in 2006 with Bo Burnham doing that little song from his bedroom in Hamilton, Massachusetts. Suddenly he's more popular than hundreds, if not thousands, of comedians who have toured these clubs for decades. Now we have podcasting. The sitting president of the United States, Barack Obama, is doing a podcast with Marc Maron on WTF. Little podcast shows, not out of Studio One at NBC, out of his garage. And then the ability to stream specials whenever you wanted them, on demand. The company that embraced stand-up, and we're living in this era right now, is the Netflix special. We get Bill Burr, we get Ali Wong, we get John Mulaney, we get a host of other comedians with these specials. I'm going to leave you with this before we get to the Q&A part of this with Young Larry. Stand-up comedy is a generational art form. It's very ethereal. It's for this time. And then the power of it dissipates as time goes on. And that's because social norms change, acceptable language changes, topics change, the way we speak changes. And so cutting-edge comedians, the funniest people ever in a few generations, can seem out of touch, hacky, or even unfunny to current generations. It's just the nature of the art form. So there you go. The definition of stand-up. How stand-ups become popular in those destinations. And then finally, why stand-up comedy doesn't tend to age that well. It's sort of like milk. It goes bad.
Most old TV comedies taste like spoiled milk. An exception seems to be physical comedy. Take that I Love Lucy skit when Lucy takes a job at the chocolate factory. Few words are spoken, the machine starts to move faster, and we see that panic in her eyes when she starts to eat the chocolates. That is chocolate, not milk. Why is this scene timeless?
Great question. Physical bits do tend to have a little longer life. However, I feel like pie in the face, pie fights, I don't know if those are still funny. Stand up, unlike a physical comedy bit, like what Chaplin does, where he's dancing with the potatoes on the end of the fork. That sort of is still wonderful to watch, in my opinion. And I want to be very careful here, because for someone to say that's not funny maybe you should start thinking about saying, that's not funny to me anymore, as opposed to that's not funny, as if you know what funny is and what funny isn't.
Is Chris Farley falling on the table timeless?
Physical comedy tends to have a basic human reaction. It's like what Mel Brooks used to say, if I cut my finger on a piece of paper, it's tragedy, but if somebody else falls into a manhole and dies, that's comedy.
Does successful stand-up require a long humorous story with a narrative arc?
It can be, but usually it isn't. Usually it's little comedy bits that are strung together as opposed to a long arc of a story. There are comedians that do long form. Mike Birbiglia does a long form story and then all the way through are great jokes. There's others that do the complete opposite, one-liner comedians, Rodney Dangerfield, Stephen Wright. The jokes aren't connected in any way. Henny Youngman was known as the king of one-liners. He started in the 30s, so that's been going on for a while.
In your book, you mentioned that in the 90s, stand-up comedy clubs expanded dramatically and then fell on hard times. What happened?
We were oversaturated with clubs, and comedians and club owners both got super greedy. It was like the price of a movie or something. Now it was three times that price with drinks. Plus, people could see stand-up at home on Evening at the Improv, and so that caused a retrenchment. It's not like there was never comedy clubs in the early 90s. It's just there wasn't as many as there were in 1989.
How does a young comic get discovered now?
The internet. There's a new phenomenon called front-facing comedians. There were comedians that used their cell phone and flipped the camera around and just literally just taped themselves doing a bit or doing a character, or in the case of one woman, lip-synced Donald Trump press conference about COVID, and she ended up getting a CBS show and a Showtime special. The old school way of doing open mics, getting into a comedy club, and then touring these clubs still exists as well. But there's myriad ways of getting in right now. Comedians do it every day. I love it.
In your opening remarks, you mentioned the power of premier booking locations to act as gatekeepers. Who are the new gatekeepers?
If you want to do SNL, you got to go through Lauren. If you want to be on The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon, there's a booker for that show that you're going to have to please. There are still a lot of gatekeepers that you have to impress. If you have enough fans and followers, these people will want those fans to come to the clubs. And there's many comedians that tour on the strength of their podcast. There's been SNL cast members that have gotten on the show because they put up a YouTube video of their impressions. That was seen by SNL, and they got on the show.
Many of the great comedians pivoted from stand-up to TV sitcoms. Is that still the natural career progression?
If we go back to Jack Benny and Fred Allen doing their stand-up acts in vaudeville, they jumped on the chance to do a radio show. Same with Bob Hope. When you're a stand-up comedian, you've already proven that you know how to unlock laughter from audiences, and then they can put them into a sitcom. Bob Newhart, who had incredible comedy records starting in 1960, got the Bob Newhart show up. He was a perfect fit for it. Whereas someone like Don Rickles had a string of failed sitcoms his whole career.
In your book, you mentioned that Don Rickles had three shows a night in Vegas. One at midnight, 2:30 a.m., and then 5 a.m., which you called the breakfast show.
Vegas was a very interesting experiment in how to keep people in a casino. That was the whole mission statement of Las Vegas. Every minute a customer was in the casino meant money for that building. They would put these acts in the lounge to keep audiences there as long as possible. Carson was headlining in the main room. He would come over, or Sinatra, come over to see Rickles in the lounge. So now, a yokel coming from the Midwest of the country to see comedy, you could see this big headliner. Then later on, it's like, oh my God, there's Sinatra sitting next to me being made fun of by Don Rickles. This is incredible. So you never knew what was going to happen in these lounge performances. They were very spontaneous. They were very improvisational. And Rickles had to work some crazy hours.
My dad once went to see a Don Rickles performance, and he told me that he was still laughing from two jokes ago. Rickles would be firing off so many jokes that the audience simply couldn't keep up with him.
I mean, he was just a machine. He had a bunch of lines ready to go. On top of that, he was an extremely gifted improvisational comedian. No matter what the situation, he would have a sarcastic comment. It was just a rapid fire Gatling gun of comedy that came at you, and people loved him.
How much does a stand-up comic rely on his writers?
That still happens. I think for the most part, when we got to Pryor and Carlin especially, Carlin was like, everything I'm saying on stage is something I wrote. So the writer became the performer, where they were called gag writers, literally back then. When radio became popular, the vaudeville gag writer was suddenly in huge demand because there was so much material you had to create every week for your radio show, as opposed to vaudeville, where you could tour for years, maybe decades, on the same act, the same bulletproof 12 minutes. Most comedians now write their own material, but other comedians help them out or workshop jokes or bounce jokes off of each other. I did a show in Aspen with Jerry Seinfeld. I was his opening act. And then afterwards, I gave him a few what they're called tags, which are extra jokes on part of a premise. And he ended up using one of them. That happens all the time in stand-up. A comedian will come up to you and go, oh, you're missing this little nugget here that you didn't think of. It just hit me. Let me give you that.
Making fun of politicians is core to the stand-up act. Why is Trump a bigger target than Biden?
Trump was singularly interesting because there was a lot you could really mock. The cadence of his voice, but they parody Joe Biden on SNL. There'll always be political comedy. The guy who really started it on stage in a big way was Will Rogers. Any comedian that you see that does political comedy, whether it's Trevor Noah, Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, or any of the SNL update guys, they all work in the shadow of this guy, Will Rogers.
Why should people care about the history of stand-up? Why is that important? Why did you write this book? What motivated
you? That's a great, you know, the way you say it. It's like I'm being interviewed by Mike Wallace. What? Why would you write something like this?
Why would you do such a thing? Did your mother know you did this?
I love it. No one has really written the history of stand-up before. I thought I was uniquely qualified to not only write this book, but do it in a very breezy, easy to digest style. No one has really boiled it down to like, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, this happened, this, and that's how we got to today. That's how Will Rogers is connected to Samantha Bee. This is how Bob Hope is connected to John Mulaney. This is how the whole thing is all one big narrative. Even though the venues change, standing alone on stage getting laughs remains the core job description.
What is the future for stand-up?
There's people that don't do it on stage. They do it on the internet at their home. There will be a new technology that will change the nature of stand-up, the way it did with records, the microphone, television, the internet. There will be a new technology that I will not invent, that I will probably miss buying stock in the company, and that will change the nature of stand-up or alter the nature of stand-up.
What do you make of Jerry Seinfeld's decision to stop performing on college campuses out of fear?
I teach on a college campus. I profess on these campuses. The student body is very sensitive about anything that might be offensive. Even the most benign jokes, there is definitely a virtue signaling from the audience of like, hey, I want you to know I don't appreciate you making that kind of generality about women or children. I did hundreds of colleges when I was starting out. And right at the end, I started getting topics you're not allowed to talk about. we have a lot of free speech in stand-up. Unfortunately, there's a little area around the edges where the walls are coming back in, kind of like in Star Wars when they're in that garbage dump and the walls keep coming in. When I was a kid, the walls kept expanding. When Carlin came along, and suddenly we could speak about anything, that was the freedom, even if sometimes you might get offended. I produced an HBO documentary about him that'll be out in May. He used to say, the obligation of the stand-up is to find the line and then deliberately go over it. I do want a world where comedians find the line and go over it. That's where we get Sam Kennison's and Lenny Bruce's.
For the first time in my life, I hear my friends consistently say that they cannot express their opinion in public on a whole host of topics.
Most comedians understand that societal norms change over time. There used to be a bunch of jokes about hitting your wife, the honeymooners. One of the big running gags on that show was, one of these days, Alice, I'm going to hit you so hard you're going to go to the moon. There would never be a sitcom today with that. Very mainstream shows like Seinfeld or Friends. Go to the internet and type in Seinfeld, problematic, those two words. And there's article after article after article after article about why these shows are offensive, why they're homophobic, why they're fat-shaming. I'm not even talking about an edgy comedian in a nightclub. I'm talking about mainstream prime-time television from the 90s is now considered problematic by people who are easily offended by something that doesn't fit into their specific worldview.
Why are there so many Jewish stand-up comedians and gag writers?
In the late 1800s, from Eastern Europe, Jews started coming to the United States, and show business was very much open. The primary focus of these comedians was to assimilate. Some of them got nose jobs. Milton Berle, I'm looking at you. But most of them changed their names. Milton Berle was Mendel Berlinger. Jerome Levitch became Jerry Lewis. Leonard Schneider became Lenny Bruce. They all de-Jewed their names to get into mainstream, what they call Goyim society, and succeed. There's a Talmudic tradition of questioning and looking at things from a different way, and a lot of stand-up comedy is that. I'll give you a perfect example. The sign, no swimming allowed. You can look at it and go, no swimming allowed. Or you can look at that sign and go, no swimming allowed. And Jews have been doing that, debating this Torah for thousands of years. It's ridiculous. And they're still doing it.
Yeah, with little progress.
Yeah, little progress. Just a lot of going over the minutiae. If you think about Jerry Seinfeld's bit about cotton balls. I mean, he is really breaking down the minutiae. Who makes them? Why do they exist? And looking at the world with a slightly different comedic lens. That's really all stand-up is. Like, we all look at the same thing and then go, oh, this is what that is.
How did Chris Rock become a superstar?
He did something that was phenomenal, which was his big HBO special in 1996, I believe, was the year of it. He wrote some material that was so incendiary, so edgy, I would say almost overnight became a legend. That act lands him on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. He gets his own HBO series. Suddenly that relaunches his film career, and he is on his way. I've known him since he was stacking chairs at the comic strip, hoping to get on late at night. Off stage, he is like a quiet, almost nerdy little skinny kid. But on stage, he's like a panther pacing back and forth doing this incredibly forceful stand-up comedy.
Do you break down your jokes to understand why they succeed? Do you work on how to improve them to get more laughs? Humor is an art, but it doesn't mean that there isn't some science.
Basis of comedy is surprise. Oh, I didn't think of that. No swimming allowed. Is like, oh, I'm surprised. I didn't think of that. It was right there in front of me. But when it comes to the writing, I subscribe, and I will give you this for free and all your listeners, to what I call the CBS. Clarity, brevity, and specificity. There's no extra words. It's very specific to what they're talking about, and it's 100% clear what the joke is. It can't be ambiguous. Clarity, brevity, and specific. Again, when he dies at comedy, it dies on the operating table. So let's do it. Let's kill some comedy right now.
Why does comedy die on the operating table? Why can't we treat it like an artistic work? You know, when we look at Monet's Water Lilies, we know it's a painting. And the more we learn about how Monet created the work, the more we can enjoy it and appreciate the artisan's craft.
You absolutely can in my class. One of the exercises they do is I have them take a routine that they love and transcribe it word for word. Bill Maher, when he first heard Robert Klein's album, Child of the 50s, he wrote down every word so he could see how many jokes, where the laughs were, where the setup, how long the setups were. I did that for the class as well, and they found it very informative. It wasn't particularly funny, but it was, like you said, almost like a science. I definitely turn a stand-up comedy from a performance art into prose.
Wayne, I end each episode on a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about?
Everything. Stand-up comedy notwithstanding, the human condition continues to improve remarkably throughout the world, and I can't wait to see artificial intelligence. Hopefully, it won't be a Terminator situation where the machines take over. I can't wait to see what we do next. People in 50 years who are listening to this podcast will have a much healthier life than we do right now.